This is the OANDA podcast.
This is the OANDA Market Insights podcast, talking to OANDA senior market analysts across the world. And today we're joined by Craig Earlham in London. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks. We've had the latest UK inflation figures out today, and prices continue to rise at their fastest rate for more than 40 years, mainly driven by higher petrol and food costs. The number, well, it's jumped to 9.4% in the 12 months to June, up from 9.1% in May. How did markets look at those figures?
Yeah, it's not just the weather here that's scorching, right? This inflation data is red hot. It's not, what is it, 9.4% and getting closer now to what the Bank of England is expecting with double-digit inflation, actually above 11% inflation later on this year when we see the energy price cap rise again. The core reading wasn't so bad, so I think that's I think that's probably one slightly positive takeaway. Maybe it doesn't really change anything, to be honest. I don't think, and in fact, the pound actually fell in the aftermath of the data because it really, because of that headline number, it was seen that the Bank of England's probably going to have a little bit more pressure to raise rates more aggressively. So the odds of a 50 basis point rate hike rather than 25, which is what we've seen since the end of last year from the Bank of England, the odds of 50 rose from around 91% to around 94% in the aftermath of that. So still basically nailed on, even though, interestingly, Andrew Bailey yesterday was at pains to suggest that the markets may be thinking this is set in stone, but it's very much not set in stone. He's saying it's never set in stone. This is what the discussions at the policy meeting are all about. And while it's very much up for consideration, there's still a decision to be made. Markets very much disagree. In fact, markets don't just disagree about this one. Markets have priced in a 94% chance of a 50 basis point rate hike in next week. They've got a strong likelihood of a 50 basis point rate hike then again at the next meeting, and a very strong chance of a 50 basis point rate hike at the meeting after that, taking interest rates to around 3% by the end of the year. So markets are very much ahead of the curve compared to where the central bank is willing to accept it's at. But then the central bank is also working on the premise that we're going to see a recession later on this year, and perhaps that energy prices, are at least oil prices, for example, may potentially pull back a little bit, and a combination of factors may do part of their job ultimately for them. So all considered, the fact that the pound pulled back, I think, is the key takeaway in all this. Not necessarily against the dollar, it actually moved a little bit higher against the dollar, but against the euro and a few other currencies, we actually saw it edge lower. And the reason for that was quite simple, really. It was the fact that every extra rate hike in the UK is seen as deepening a recession. Whereas in ordinary times, when you've got a red hot economy and you start seeing more inflation as a result of that, rate hikes are seen as being positive for the currency because the economy is seen as to be able to sustain such a tightening cycle. That's very much not the case here in the UK. Any extra rate hike just adds to the pain that the economy is going to feel regardless. So that's why we saw the pound actually drop, even though rate hike expectations increased.
And you mentioned the petrol prices, petrol and diesel, possibly having an effect on future inflation rates. Could we see a lower rate when the July figures come out?
Yeah, July or August, you would expect we may see a lower rate. Probably not July so much, actually, because now, it's the 20th of July today, and the petrol price haven't really started coming down yet. So I think probably more likely to be August, September time when we'll start to see a little bit lower rate of inflation. But we've got to remember as well that petrol prices aren't going to fall that considerably. They're still going to be well above where they were prior to the invasion of Ukraine. We may see them drop 10, 15 pence a litre, but when we're dropping from 190, 195 a litre down to 180, it's nothing to write home about. It's still going to cost for many people around 100 quid to fill your tank. So, I mean, this compared to last year, there's still going to be a lot of inflationary pressure coming from that petrol price, but it may take some of the edge off of it. If it's seen as a sustainable move, which again, I'm not convinced about, then that could potentially remove some of that headline peak. But that comes back to what I was just saying about the sustainability of these oil prices. So a barrel of Brent crude is currently trading at 106, WTI is around 103. The question is, can this be sustained? And well, what's driving it? Well, it's being driven, really, the move lower by the prospect of recession. It's not being driven by higher output. In fact, we saw President Biden's trip at the weekend seemingly very unsuccessful. MBS got his fish pump, got the photo op, got his face-to-face meeting, and then the noises which come out since suggest that the US kind of walked away empty-handed. Now, we'll see how much of that is true when we get the next OPEC meeting in a couple of weeks' time. But in terms of where the oil prices are now, recession is the only big downside risk as far as these oil prices are concerned. This is still an extremely tight market, and therefore I think there's a lot of people are looking at the oil price now around $100 a barrel and saying that there's probably more upside risk than there is downside. So even if we do see, which is the point I'm trying to make, even if we do see some downside pressure on oil, on price at the pump in the short term, do not be surprised if we see that reverse course and many of these petrol stations finally break £2 a litre.
Staying with energy, Craig, let's talk about Nord Stream 1. What is happening there? It's been closed for the last few days, but there is a chance that it might be reopening.
So it's been closed for scheduled maintenance. So this is something that's been planned for a long time. It's something that happens on an annual basis. It was a 10-day maintenance period. The fear was that it seems this year that there's almost any opportunity to kind of reduce flows to Europe seems to be capitalized upon as long as there's a suitable excuse. And we've seen it, for example, with the return of a part to Canada and the issues that were with returning that that part because of the sanctions that are currently in place. Now, you could say, well, that is a suitable excuse. That is a good reason why the part of the pipeline maybe wasn't functioning as well as planned and as well as it normally would. And I think flows are running around 40% to Germany as a result of that. Where the excuse kind of loses some of its substance is that there was alternative ways to get gas to Germany. There was alternative pipelines, alternative routes that Russia rejected and Gazprom rejected, and therefore people are naturally eyeing this with a healthy dose of scepticism. Now, when these flows were reduced over the course of last month and earlier this week, Gazprom wrote to a number of these companies using the force majeure clause, saying that events outside of their control were the reason behind it. Effectively, it's kind of just a legal argument to say that it's not our fault, even though there was alternatives that could have been utilised. Then all of a sudden, there was a lot of speculation that, hold on, we've been concerned for some time that Gazprom could use the 10-day maintenance period as a means of reducing flows to Europe on a long-term basis, citing anything from prolonged issues to parts not being returned. And we were going to find out this Thursday whether that's going to be the case. Now, the noises, yes, they suggest that actually the pipeline is going to restart as planned and that flows will continue to return to Europe. But in terms of the scale with which that's going to happen, that's still very much up in the air. So there's still a lot of anxiety around what that will be. Putin, again, yesterday suggesting, kind of dropping hints that it may not be fully operational. But again, we'll see on Thursday and we'll see what happens now over the week's ahead. In terms of why this is important, well, it's important because we need gas, we need energy. But also it's important because European stocks are running at around 60% now. And they need to get more towards 80, 90% going into that winter period, because what typically happens in the gas market is these companies will fill their storage over the course of the warmer summer months when people aren't using heating, and then draw down on it over the winter. And that's kind of the cycle that happens. But because of various disruptions, filling those storage has been much harder. We saw that they were already low last winter, and now the fear is that this winter storage will be well below where they would want it to be, which kind of gives Russia the upper hand. So all of a sudden, Europe is very vulnerable to Russia shutting off the gas and leaving it in deep bother. And that's the fears that has been emanating around Europe for the last 12 months, and it's going to become increasingly heightened now over the months ahead. Step one towards alleviating that is the pipeline resuming on Thursday as planned. And after that, it's all about volume.
Let's move on to Netflix, Craig. And it has lost almost 1 million subscribers between April and July as the number of people quitting the service accelerates, but that was not as many as the streaming giant had feared, was it?
It wasn't. I mean, it's an interesting thing, right? A platform that for so many years have seen extraordinary growth in terms of its share price and users, and the share price has moved in line with with the number of users on the platform and the growth that we've seen there and the expectation of how much it can continue to grow in the years ahead. And now you've got investors celebrating the fact that they've only lost 1 million subscribers. In terms of why they've lost a million, I mean, there's a number of reasons. One is the extraordinary growth we saw during the pandemic. People aren't locked up at home anymore, so people don't need streaming services quite as much as they did. The other thing is... The other thing is that there's so much competition now. Netflix were the first streaming service. They were the first one that people had, and they kind of set the bar for where other companies need to be. And for a long time, it felt like they've been very much ahead of everyone else. But others have played catch-up and spent billions on playing catch-up in that process, whether that's Apple, whether that's Disney+, whether that's Amazon Prime. The list goes on. There's now so much competition. And the problem from a shareholder perspective is that it's very easy to unsubscribe to these services and move on to another if the content isn't continuing to pull you in. You need to continue to have hit after hit after hit. The good thing for Netflix is, and that's why I think the number of subscribers fell by less than people were expecting, is Stranger Things. So this is the hit show that the series 4 has kind of kept people engaged, and the result has been fewer people unsubscribing. So they need to continue to find these big hits after big hits after big hits to continue to maintain and even grow their subscribers. But that's obviously easier said than done when others are spending billions on their content as well. The other difficulty that they have is there is a cost of living crisis. I'm not sure if you've heard. And when there is a cost of living crisis, if people are having to cut back on their spending and they're looking as to where they can cut back on their spending, then unfortunately for companies like Netflix, that it's kind of an easy pick. It's easy to pull back on those streaming services where you're not locked into a contract and you can just cancel your subscription and immediately save however much every single month. So they're always going to be vulnerable to that kind of shift and that kind of decision making. They also have other issues that they need to overcome with regards to multiple users within and outside of households, other people using your password and logging in onto the same service rather than paying twice. So they have a number of issues to overcome. But the fact that Stranger Things kind of saved them this time, the most important thing for them is they need to continue to push out more and more and more content in order to keep people engaged. And then it's also about how do they expand their offering? How do they continue to draw people in more? Can they rely purely on video streaming? Can they rely purely on continuing to knock out these big, big winners in order to keep people engaged? Or do they need to expand? This is where the deal with Microsoft and gaming comes into it. But also you look at someone like Amazon Prime, they offer so many different things in order to try and keep people engaged. It's not just about the Prime Video, it's also about the shopping service, deliveries and everything else that comes within it, all within this one offering. And now football, of course, with Amazon Prime at times as well. Netflix needs, I think, to diversify in terms of its offering in order to try and keep people engaged and to draw bigger crowds, and it has a massive task on its hand. I think people are going to be really keenly watching Netflix now over the coming years, because the fear is that they've kind of set the bar really high, but others are playing catch up much faster and they are struggling as a result ultimately.
Okay, Craig, thanks very much for joining us this morning. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
This is the Oanda Podcast.